Today is Tuesday, February 5th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, what to expect from President Trump's State of the Union address with the threat of another government shutdown looming. Trump administration says it may not be possible to reunite thousands of separated immigrant families.
The scale of trauma experienced not only by the children, but also by the parents who are being forcibly separated from their children without any justification under the facts or the law. That abuse rose to the level of torture in some of the cases that Amnesty International documented.
Calls continue to grow for a U.S. governor to resign. Also, 35 years ago today, one of the most influential songs in history hit the number one spot on the Billboard charts. Well, U.S. President Donald Trump delivers his second State of the Union address this evening to a very different and more combative Congress than the one he spoke to last year. He's expected to praise the U.S. economy and insist on the need for a physical barrier on the U.S. border with Mexico. He's also likely to praise his administration's foreign policies, citing talks with North Korea and the Taliban, and he will declare the defeat of Islamic State in Syria. The address was originally scheduled for January 29th, but was postponed due to the longest ever U.S. government shutdown over his fight with congressional Democrats over funding for the border wall. VOA's Latika Hoke reports Tuesday's address comes as another government funding deadline is looming.
Trump is expected to present himself as a strong leader who is delivering on his campaign promises. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell gave a hint that the success of the U.S. economy could be foremost.
Republicans' pro-growth, pro-family economic policies have helped our nation's job creators and small businesses hit the accelerator, and middle-class families across the country continue to reap the rewards.
The Democrats are prepared to respond, as demonstrated by Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer.
Tomorrow, the president will say predictably that the state of our union is strong. But the truth is, the state of the Trump economy is failing America's middle class. The state of the Trump health care system is failing American families. And the state of the Trump administration is embroiled in chaos and incompetence.
Trump has acknowledged that he may not be able to get enough congressional support to finance construction of a border wall, his other major campaign promise. He has said he may declare a national emergency to get the necessary funds and could use the State of the Union to push for that option. Senator Lindsey Graham has urged fellow Republicans to support him.
If the Democrats won't work with him, I think it would be bad for the Republicans to undercut him if he tries to put the barriers in place using his power as commander-in-chief.
Trump is also likely to declare success in U.S. mediation in Afghanistan as a justification to end the 17-year-long U.S. engagement there. Rand Paul, a Republican senator from Kentucky, is also a passionate supporter of the withdrawal of U.S. troops from both Syria and Afghanistan.
By any measurement, we are victorious. We killed bin Laden. We have disrupted the terror camps in Afghanistan. Is Afghanistan a mess? Sure, it's a mess. It's always been a mess and always will be a mess.
But some lawmakers on both sides of the aisle oppose the withdrawal.
One of our colleagues, the senator from Florida, Senator Rubio, said, really, terrorism is like a tumor. It's like a cancer. And you can try to eliminate it, but if you're unsuccessful in eliminating it, even though you've shrunk it, it will come back as soon as you remove the pressure.
Trump also is expected to claim progress in his administration's trade negotiations with China and talks with North Korea on denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. Zlatica Hoke, VOA News, Washington.
Here are some of the stories we are following at voanews.com. Islamic State resurgence is expected within months. A U.S. judge reschedules the sentencing hearing for former Trump campaign chair Paul Manafort. The U.S. calls on allies to repatriate IS prisoners from Syria. And can peaceful protests change Uganda? Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. A top administration official for Virginia's governor, Ralph Northam, says the governor is meeting with staff to hear their assessment of whether it's viable for him to stay in office. Northam has rebuffed widespread calls for his resignation after a racist photo surfaced Friday from his 1984 medical school yearbook page. Almost all key political leaders in Virginia and Washington, Democrats and Republicans alike, along with 2020 U.S. Democratic presidential candidates, said Northam, a Democrat 13 months into a four-year term, should resign. But he has so far resisted, telling his closest aides he needed more time to decide what to do, whether to quit or try to ride out the storm and attempt to restore his reputation. Secretary of Finance Aubrey Lane said he's told Northam the state can't afford a prolonged period of uncertainty over his future. Joining us to talk more about it is Kyle Condick, managing editor of Sabatow's Crystal Ball at the University of Virginia Center for Politics. You are right in the center of the controversy down there. What can you tell us?
It has been a very unusual number of days, particularly because after the story broke on Friday, the governor gave this press conference on Saturday in which I think he hoped to kind of stem the tide of defections from his court. And it ended up making the situation even worse. His presentation at the press conference was widely panned, and you had some of the holdouts who had not been calling for his resignation, such as U.S. Senators Mark Warner and Tim Kaine of Virginia, both of whom were Democrats. They had previously not asked for Northam's resignation. They did after that press conference. Basically, the only major Democrat that has not really weighed in so yet is former President Barack Obama. And I wonder if he may eventually be asked to ask Northam to leave. Ultimately, for as much criticism as Northam is taking and as much support as he's lost, it's ultimately up to him as to whether he wants to resign or not. And if he wants to continue in office, he can. No one can necessarily force him out. I mean, he could be impeached, but the Republican Speaker of the Virginia House of Delegates just suggested today that maybe impeachment would not be appropriate, even though certainly Republicans don't think that Northam should continue either. So this is the situation we're in, where we have a governor whose support is tanking, and yet the big push for him to go came over the weekend, and yet he remained.
All these calls for him to resign, whether it's coming from Republicans or Democrats, organizations or whatever, some are making the point that regardless of whether, it happened, it didn't happen, he's sorry, he may be sincere, that he's just basically lost the faith in his constituents and in the people of the state of Virginia. So some are saying that would be the logical thing to do, would be to just step aside for the good of the state.
Well, I think that a big part of Northam's problem, I mean, this was going to be a damaging story no matter what, but the fact that the day that it came out, he essentially apologized for seeming, he suggested that he was in fact in the photo, and then a day later he reversed course and said that he did think it was him. He also, at that press conference, essentially admitted to being in blackface at another time in that same year that the yearbook came out, which really just led to more questions. And he also claimed that there were other mistakes in this yearbook from his medical school that contained this photo of two people, one in blackface, one in a Ku Klux Klan outfit. And I think it might have been helpful to the governor if he could have pointed to other instances of mistakes in the yearbook, but he really has not done that. So I think from his press conference, there's not really been that much follow-through from him, which I also think doesn't bolster his case.
Do you think he recognizes why this is so painful to so many people?
Only he can know that. I will say that his press conference, that I think was designed to be apologetic, conciliatory, I think a lot of people, including people of color, didn't really take it that way. Maybe didn't think that he really understood the ramifications of that photograph and him seeming to acknowledge being in it and then taking that back. It does lead to sort of a larger cultural questions about this photo appeared in this yearbook and someone had to choose to use that photo, and it certainly makes it seem like that sort of behavior was acceptable back then, which is kind of a larger cultural problem beyond Northam.
That's Kyle Condick, managing editor of Sabatow's Crystal Ball at the University of Virginia Center of Politics. Until recently, Venezuela's Juan Guaido was just another lawmaker in the country's National Assembly that had been stripped of its powers after the opposition won control of the body in 2015. But now Guaido, who became the assembly's head in January, has declared himself Venezuela's interim president and is leading a movement to force the sitting president, Nicolas Maduro, to step down. Bill Rogers has this profile of the young, charismatic opposition leader who seems to have captured the support of Venezuelans desperate for change after 20 years of failed socialist policies.
He was unknown to most of the world just a few weeks ago. Now, Juan Guaido is at the center of a massive movement to topple Venezuela's embattled socialist president, Nicolas Maduro.
Venezuelan men and women, pledge yourself to Venezuela with social justice.
The 35-year-old National Assembly speaker took center stage last month when he declared himself Venezuela's interim president. Recognized by the United States and a host of other nations, Guaido has promised to hold elections to usher in a new era for a country plagued by shortages of food, medicine, and hyperinflation. He's the man of the hour, says Venezuelan-Israeli economist Danny Bahar.
Until recently, he was not very well known in the public sphere, but he actually has come across as somebody who's been able to manage to unify the opposition and to bring a lot of hope that was missing.
It was the devastating floods of 1999 in his home state of Vargas and the government's failure to rebuild after the devastation that spurred the young Guaido to pursue politics after getting an engineering degree at the university. Over the years, he participated in opposition protests against Maduro, who continued the socialist policies of his predecessor, Hugo Chavez, who died in office in 2013. Re-elected last year in a vote widely viewed as rigged, protests intensified after Maduro was sworn into office for another six-year term in January.
Libertad! Libertad!
What makes these protests different is that Venezuela's opposition is united behind Guaido.
It is known that the opposition inside has really struggled to come across one message, one strategy. And suddenly comes this person who was relatively unknown, who comes from a very humble background, and he's a new face, and who had the courage of doing what many people thought that was impossible.
Forcing Maduro to step down remains a challenge. Meanwhile, the opposition has offered a wide-ranging program to rebuild Venezuela, though some Latin American observers are skeptical.
A lot of people anticipate that under a sort of Guaido-led government, there would be a reduction of the government's involvement in social programs to help the poor and so on, and that, you know, they're often associated with the Venezuelan elites as opposed to, the Venezuelan poor.
But on the streets of Caracas, most Venezuelans are hopeful about Guaido and the opposition.
Until now, I'm confident that the actions they're taking will lead us to resolve this situation that is so difficult for all Venezuelans.
Guaido has pledged to hold free and fair elections and, in a VOA interview, did not rule out running for president if that is the consensus of the opposition. But for now, the rallies and protests are expected to continue until Maduro steps down. Bill Rogers for VOA News, Washington.
Well, there will be several congressional committee hearings this week and next on the Trump administration's policy of separating migrant children from their parents. It's an issue that has so far received little oversight. The hearings come as the Trump administration says it would require extraordinary effort to reunite what may be thousands of migrant children who've been separated from their parents. And the administration said even if it could, the children would likely be emotionally harmed. Health and Human Services Department officials said in court filings late Friday that removing children from sponsor homes to rejoin their parents would endanger their welfare. The officials say they don't have authority to take children away from sponsors and that the effort would be cost prohibitive. The government didn't adequately track separated children before a judge in San Diego ruled in June that children in its custody be reunited with their parents. There will be congressional hearings, again, as we said, on this issue. Joining us to discuss, Amnesty International U.S. researcher Brian Griffey. Thanks for being with us. What's Amnesty's position on all of this?
From the start, we have not had a full reckoning by the Trump administration as to the scale of abuse under, first of all, a zero-tolerance policy of family separation in 2018. But prior to that, there has neither been accountability for the thousands of other family separations that were conducted even before it became an official Trump administration policy. So far, because there has not been a full reckoning, Congress does not know and the American public does not know how many children were actually ever separated, how many children have the separations recorded in official records, and how many might have fallen off the grid. So before the Trump administration can claim what it can or can't do in terms of reuniting families, it has to first come clean about the full scale of abuse and put that information before the public and before Congress for public scrutiny.
When you say abuse, are you referring to splitting up families?
That's right. In all 50 states of the United States, the best interest of the child is the legal standard that prevails in terms of considerations as to what should happen when the human rights of children are at stake. And from the get-go, this policy ran counter to that. The Trump administration never considered the best interest of the child or of the families, and it violated its own policies on family unity of the Department of Homeland Security when it conducted these family separations in order to deter asylum seekers from seeking safe haven in the United States. Scale of the abuse, when I say abuse, I mean the scale of trauma experienced not only by the children, but also by the parents who are being forcibly separated from their children without any justification under the facts or the law. That abuse rose to the level of torture in some of the cases that Amnesty International documented, both due to the deterrence that was the purpose of it, as well as due to the harm that was inflicted on these families.
What do you say about the notion that it could be too traumatic at this point to remove these children from their sponsor families in the U.S.?
The idea that it's more traumatic to reunite families than to keep them separated is spurious, and it's just another effort that seems to be resisting accountability and a full accounting by this administration to come clean on the scale of abuse. When Amnesty International released a report last October that revealed that thousands more families appeared to have been separated than the government had come clean on, in response to the report, it denied those claims and made a number of false statements that were suggesting that the class action lawsuit from last summer had covered all of the families that were separated. Now we have a report that just came out from the Office of Inspector General of the Department of Health and Human Services that confirms what Amnesty International found last October. And yet the government still has not been forced to come before Congress and come clean about the scale of abuse.
Do we have any better idea of who these families are that have been separated from parents and children?
The reason that the government is now admitting that it may have separated thousands more families than it originally admitted is that it didn't actually start counting until last April of 2018. So from the beginning of the Trump administration up until April of last year, we already knew that there may have been thousands more families that had been separated that they weren't counting. And now the government's own report has come clean about that to a certain extent. But in terms of who those families are, many of them may have been families where the child was released to another family member or to a sponsor and was no longer in the custody of the government at the time the court case was decided. So many of these people are parents who are still in detention now, sometimes more than a year after they were separated from their child and still haven't been reunified. Just last week, there was a Brazilian mother who was separated from her son last March of 2018, who still has not been reunited with her son. She's afraid of even being visited by the son in detention because it will be so re-traumatizing for her. The solution that needs to happen is that these parents and children need to be identified. And if the parents are still in detention, they need to be released and reunified with the children, like happened in all of the other thousands of cases that were identified previously.
I'm not sure about the legal ramifications of all of this for the Trump administration, but I understand that congressional Democrats are planning on holding hearings on these matters. Is that correct?
That's correct. Both this week and next week, House committees are going to be hearing from agency representatives as well as non-governmental organizations about the real truth of matters in terms of the number of children who were separated and what blind spots there are in terms of the government's accounting of that policy. Now that the government has admitted that thousands more families may have been separated than it previously disclosed, I think there are going to be a number of important questions that lawmakers are asking, and Amnesty International will also be submitting a statement to Congress outlining our findings of our report last year that also confirmed that thousands more families appeared to have been separated than originally disclosed.
All right. That is Amnesty International U.S. researcher Brian Griffey. Thanks for being with us. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. VOAnews.com.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues. In Zimbabwe, migration from rural to urban areas has created a demand for housing, leading to construction on wetlands and concerns about the environment and water supplies. Columbus Mavhunga has more from Harare.
Conservation groups in Zimbabwe warn that the invasion of the country's wetlands for infrastructure development and streambank cultivation in urban areas threatens the management of underground water and the availability of the resource. They say the problem has been exacerbated by people moving from rural to urban areas. Those include Zevai Muchichwe, a father of three. Muchichwe says he built his home on a wetland 3 years ago as Harare battled to contain the migration from the rural parts of the country. Now he says part of the dwelling has cracked and fallen. Muchichwe says he's waiting for authorities to tell him whether he will be there permanently as the structure needs to be reinforced. He says it was built hurriedly with cheap material, and because of the location, the problem of water underground exists. We thought we'd be here for just a year, he said. Harare authorities say they will soon start water rationing because of low levels. Dorothy Wakeling of conservation group Harare Wetlands Trust says she was not surprised by the announcement. She says people are disturbing wetlands, which are supposed to be gradually releasing water into the city's water bodies.
If you don't have this and you've got monoculture, all you get is runoff, and you've lost the opportunity for the water to get into the ground, which has been so carefully laid out by nature. It's not there by mistake, and we're discarding it for one plant or buildings, when that is the way we get our water. You can't make water come any other way.
The group says it hopes that President Emmerson Mnangagwa's government does not allow construction of the Monavu wetland, which it says holds water for most Harare water bodies. Steady Kangata is from Zimbabwe's environmental agency. Kangata says the agency is working to ensure any disturbance of wetlands and stream banks is at a minimum.
We must not be selfish when it comes to the environment. We are urging anyone who would want to do any form of construction to ascertain the nature as well as the status of the piece of land where they want to undertake the development. The entire world is about the green economy. It's the economy of the environment, where the environment is the pinnacle of any economy, and we should mainstream environmental issues in anything that we do.
For now, Muchichwe's family and neighbors remain uncertain as to whether they will have a place to stay. Given that the rainy season is not set to end until about late March, they might be sleeping on wet floors. Columbus Mavhunga for VOA News, Harare.
In health news, we talk about skin lightening products. According to one estimate, more than 70 million people in Nigeria use skin lightening products regularly, making Africa's most populous country the capital of skin bleaching. But some women are rejecting the trend, saying their natural dark skin is beautiful just the way it is. Timothy Obizu reports for VOA from Abuja. and tells us that Nigeria remains a huge market for skin whitening products.
25-year-old Nigerian model and actress Goodness Ben visits a cosmetic shop in Abuja. She wants to be famous and says bleaching her skin could increase her chances at getting more movie roles.
Yes, this is Nigeria. A fair skin is business. That's what it's business. In movie industry, most times the director wants you to like glow. In fact, you should be camera friendly. You know, most times dark people tend to, will I say resist? I don't know. But they are more beautiful and they are catchy when they come in contact with the camera.
According to a 2011 estimate from the World Health Organization, 76 million Nigerians, mostly women, use skin lightening products regularly. Some darker-skinned Nigerians are pushing back against the idea that lighter is better. They say black is beautiful with the so-called melanin movement. Tina Ohanu says she doesn't need to bleach her skin.
My confidence really doesn't come from my skin. It comes from within. And I still get as much attention from the male folk as every other lady should. So I don't think it has anything to do with my confidence.
Bleaching products usually contain hydroquinone, corticosteroids or mercury as key ingredients. These chemicals could have a range of side effects when used regularly, according to skin experts.
You can have stretch marks, the skin becomes fragile, doesn't heal properly. Sometimes you can have, some of them can give you abnormal skin odor, abnormal odor, excessive sweating, poor wound healing, so, and then it ages faster.
The beauty industry in Africa is worth several billion dollars and increases by 8 to 10% every year. Nigeria is one of the prime destinations for many beauty agents produced abroad. Ghana, Ivory Coast and Rwanda banned all whitening products while Nigeria joined South Africa in barring those with harmful chemicals. While these moves help promote natural and healthy skin tone, however, the melanin movement is still dwarfed by Africans' demand for skin lightening products. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja.
And finally, on this day in music history. Exactly 35 years ago, today, on February 5th, 1983, the rock group Toto's hit song, Africa, rose to be number one on the Billboard charts and went on to become one of the most influential rock music classics of all time in the U.S. The song continues to be appreciated to this day, and it was Toto's only number one hit on the charts.
Turned to me as if to say, hurry boy, it's waiting there for you.
You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thanks for joining us. Thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Jimmy Cook. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
The wild dogs cry out in the night as they grow restless, longing for some solitary company. Know that I must do what's right. Sure as Kilimanjaro rises like Olympus above the Serengeti. I seek to cure what's deep inside, frightened of this thing that I've become.
VOA News, I'm Tommy McNeil.